coming up on today's programme. After 52 fall ill, why was the public not alerted to contaminated water incidents? Was the President right to refuse that invitation to the partitioned church service? With leading figures walking away, can Sláintecare be resuscitated? And we'll be hearing the shocking story of what happened when a female academic researched women's experiences in the Defence Forces. Good afternoon and welcome to Saturday with Katie Hannan. My panel today, Mary Butler, Minister of State at the Department of Health, David Cullinan, Sinn Féin TD for Waterford and party spokesperson on health, Róisín Shortall, co-leader of the Social Democrats and former chair of the Committee on the Future of Healthcare. You can text us on 51551. You can email saturday@rte.ie or you can tweet to @SaturdayRTE. Now, as you heard there in the bulletin, there has been 52 confirmed cases of illness, some of whom needed to be hospitalised following incidents where contaminated water entered the public drinking water supply at two treatment plants in Gorey and Ballymore Eustace. We understand Minister Dara O'Brien was to hold a virtual meeting with Irish Water, Dublin City Council and Wexford County Council this morning to discuss the incidents, that meeting may still be ongoing, I understand. Minister Mary Butler, can you give us an update on that?
Good afternoon to all the listeners, Katie. Yeah, Minister O'Brien was only informed in writing this week from the EPA about the two serious incidents in recent weeks. And you're quite correct. Since 11:30 this morning, Minister O'Brien has been meeting with the Managing Director of Irish Water and both Chief Executives of Dublin and Wexford Councils. So that meeting is ongoing currently.
So we've no further information as to why there was that delay in informing the minister and indeed informing the public in the first place.
No, and Minister O'Brien has stated categorically that these failures are unacceptable and really concerning. And I suppose the most worrying thing is that was stated in the letter that the EPA stated that there was an abject failure in management oversight, operational control and responsiveness, which allowed unsafe water to enter drinking supply. Now, I was contacted before I came on by Senator Malcolm Byrne, who was a senator in Gorey in Wexford, and he said the issue was raised by local councillors and himself when people were feeling sick, but he feels that the concerns initially were downplayed and they're still waiting for Irish Water to confirm a meeting with local representatives. So these concerns were raised by local councillors and Senator Malcolm Byrne going back a couple of weeks.
Okay. Well, let's put that. I've got Verona Murphy, Independent TD for Wexford, on the line now. Verona, were you across this when your constituents would have been experiencing illness?
Yes, Katie, we had received some correspondence from a constituent, in which case we passed to Irish Water. And the same day that we received the correspondence, which was complaining of issues a couple of weeks previous, you know, so we got the email on the 2nd of September, but the issue was relating to some weeks prior to that, about the 20th of August. Irish Water issued us with a short statement that said, Irish Water can confirm the treatment issues at the water treatment plant in Crea, supplying water to parts of Gorey town, may have been affected, the water and the water quality in the network. The issue has since been resolved. We have conducted monitoring in the network and Irish Water are satisfied that the water quality in the network is now satisfactory. It advises those experiencing illness to contact their GP. Now, we sent further correspondence to ask the question why a boil water notice hadn't been issued. And it's only today that we learn from what the EPA has said that actually it's an abject failure on Wexford County Council's behalf that they did not notify Irish Water in time. And I think, if anything, it's paramount that people have confidence that drinking a glass of water is not going to make them sick. And what I don't want to see here now is a debacle that where staff at junior level in Wexford County Council is hung out to dry. I think it's incumbent now on the CEO, Tom Enright, to come out and clarify to the people of Wexford why this happened, what happened, when it happened, and what he is doing to ensure that this doesn't happen again. Because there is lots of talk in Wexford about staffing levels and, you know, that we have a certain level of engineering staff that are purported to be working in an area that's now called special projects, driving things like Trinity Wharf. And it appears that where we have deficits in staffing levels are in our roads and water sections. And I want to see that clarified. I want to ensure, if that is the case, that that is corrected. And we certainly do not see people ending up in hospital purported to, you know, where water and people are being infected. This is serious, very, very serious. And I am very surprised that we don't yet have a statement from the CEO of Wexford County Council.
OK, well, I actually have a statement from the minister now. That meeting apparently has ended, and I've just been handed a very brief few lines following that meeting. We're told that Minister Dara O'Brien has announced an audit of all water treatment plants following these revelations. We say that following the meeting, he said water supplies from the Cray water plant near Goree and the Ballymore Eustace plant serving parts of Dublin are safe to drink. And that's, I suppose, very important to clarify that. We're told the water is now safe to drink. He said also that there will be an audit of all water treatment plants in the country. The EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, say it is investigating the incidents last month where there was a delay in notifying the HSE and it about the problems, and there may be enforcement action up to and including prosecutions. Verona, I was just going to put that to the panel. Yes,
that's really the extremely serious part of this here. How an audit of the water plants, we all know that there's deficits all over the country in relation to water plants, but the deficit here is that the guidelines weren't followed and 53 people ended up in hospital.
Just to be clear, I don't think 53 people ended up in hospital, but there were a number of those people who became ill and did require hospital treatment.
Quite ill, yes.
Okay.
But just to say that that's where the abject failure is, and I would like to hear from the CEO of Wexford County Council on this matter. I think it is incumbent on him that he restore confidence to the people, that if we don't have confidence in drinking a glass of water, and I know that the Director of Services in this area is an extremely hard-working, competent individual, so I think the CEO is the person who needs to issue a statement here to clarify for the people of Wexford.
I just want to put that to the panel now. Sorry, Verona.
Really important. I think what the minister has issued there is a whitewash. It's a box-ticking exercise. We need answers to this. This can happen any day, anywhere, and I don't want to see it happen again.
Okay, I just put that to Mary Butler.
I think Verona has been very disingenuous here, because the first point is that Minister O'Brien was only informed in writing this week of the situation, which the EPA state was an abject failure. And the minister has responded so quickly by holding that meeting this morning. And the purpose of the meeting is to put steps in place to ensure no repeat of these incidents and an audit of water treatment plant operational arrangements. So I think turning it over, making it political and blaming the minister when he was only informed about it midweek is disingenuous of Verona.
That's not what I'm doing, Mary. I didn't blame the minister. I said it's a whitewash. I said we need to categorically answer the questions that the people want answered. How it happened, why it happened, why the guidelines weren't followed, why people were getting sick, and there was no boil water notice issued.
Roisin Shorten.
These are two very serious incidents. It's really important that the public can have confidence in the quality and safety of our water supply. And clearly there were serious problems in relation to both of these incidents. There are questions to be answered, undoubtedly, about the procedures that were followed. We need to get the facts in relation to what happened in relation to these two incidents. But more importantly, we need to know why the proper procedures weren't followed in terms of notifying the public. And, you know, it's all very well for the minister to say he's doing an audit of all water treatment plants. We need to know what happened in this situation. In these situations, we need to know where was the breakdown between Irish Water and the local authority. And there needs to be consequences for this. Like, you know, it's not a minor issue. It's a serious issue. Why was the problem created? How did the problem come about in the first place? And why were people not informed as a matter of urgency? And we need answers to those specific questions.
OK, David Cullinan.
Yeah, I think it's unacceptable that swifter action obviously was not taken. We have to find out where the breakdown in communications was, because if it can happen in this situation, it can happen elsewhere. So we obviously need to hear from Irish Water in more detail, and indeed from the local authority. But an audit of the waste treatment plants is all well and fine, but we've known for decades that there has been underinvestment in wastewater treatment plants. In fact, this state has been subject to European Court of Justice rulings, which say that we are in breach of EU directives in relation to wastewater and wastewater treatment plants. And you can go back as far as Alan Kelly, when he was the minister responsible for this area, he slashed funding for wastewater treatment plants. It's slowly been built up since then, but we have an awful lot of work to do and investment to make to get that right. And I think that has to be part of our discussion as we find out what went wrong in this particular instance as well.
Okay, we will leave that one there. And I want to thank Verona Murphy for joining us on the line there. But we're taking a break now. We'll take a break now and we will come back and discuss the that invitation that was turned down by President Michael D. Higgins after these.
Saturday with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And I've just been handed a statement from Irish Water, updated after that meeting today. And just a couple of, it's a lengthy enough statement, just a couple of lines from it that we should say. One is that it is important to note that these incidents have been rectified and that the water supply from the two plants is safe to drink. So if you're in areas where you're drinking water from those plants, that is not a problem now. And just one other line, Niall Gleeson, Managing Director of Irish Water, says, Irish Water agrees with the Minister and the EPA that both incidents are unacceptable. In both instances, late notification of issues relating to the disinfection process at the plants potentially put public health at risk. And that obviously is a very serious matter. But no doubt there'll be more on that later. But for now, we're going to move on because the controversy over President Michael D. Higgins' decision to refuse an invitation to attend a church service in Northern Ireland is rumbling on. The President has clarified that his issue is about the title of the event, which, and I'll just read out that title again, a service of reflection and hope to mark the centenary of the partition and the formation of Northern Ireland. He says this was not a neutral statement politically. I'm joined on the line now by Independent Senator Gerard Crockwell. Thanks for joining us, Gerard. Having heard now that the President's clarification of why he turned down that invitation, do you accept that that was his entitlement?
Thank you very much for having me on, Katie. Listen, my group, which is a very diverse group in the Shannon, we discussed this at length at our last meeting, and we decided that it was poor show, really. That's the best way I can put it. I've listened to the explanation. It is so out of kilter with the Michael D. Higgins that ran in the 2011 election and the Michael D. Higgins that overwhelmingly won the last election. He has always been a man to step forward with reconciliation and do his bit to try and bring this country together. I'm really interested now in finding out what advice he was given from Ivy House, from the Department of Foreign Affairs, because that seems now to be the area where the ambiguity arises. You must remember this was not a celebration, it was a commemoration.
Yeah, well, I mean, from what we know and what we've been told is that he wasn't given any specific advice in relation to how he should respond to that invitation.
And if that's a fact, and we'll have to see that advice, but if that's a fact, then that's it called into question Ivy House and exactly what's going on there, because the President appears to have ticked all the boxes that are required of him when it comes to engaging in something like this. We must remember, there are extreme unionists who will make serious mileage out of this, and the more moderate ones will be deeply hurt, and certainly the ones I speak to are hurt by the fact that the President didn't show up or is refusing to show up for this particular event. And right now I don't think he could turn up at this stage. It would be an insult now if he turned up.
David Cullinan, you think the President was right to take this position?
Well, I think in the first instance, it's a matter for him. And I disagree with Gerard. I don't believe it's a poor reflection at all on Michael D. Higgins. I think he obviously exercised his own personal judgment. He is his own person in his own right. He's obviously a Republican. I think for all of the reasons that he has given, and I'm certainly not going to speak for him, that I don't see any circumstance in which the President of Ireland would either mark or commemorate or celebrate in any way the partition of our country.
But I think, sorry, just to be clear about this, there is no, because I looked at that letter, again, the letter of invitation, there is certainly no, the word celebrate does not in any sense enter into it.
Yes, I think there's a fine line between commemorate and celebrate, but even commemorating the partition of your country and expecting a president to be part of an event that would do that, I think people just need to reflect on that. The president is his own person. He has given his view. There are obviously deep divisions on the island of Ireland, which are a consequence of partition. And partition isn't history. You know, partition is also contemporary. Our country is still divided and our country is still partitioned. And there are many people working day and night to bring about Irish unity and have an aspiration for Irish unity. And we have no problem at all with having discussions with people from the unionist community. One of our MLAs took part in such a discussion only over the last number of days to look in an insightful way and an honest way from all sides what partition brought about, its consequences, and also the different views, where obviously there are people who want to maintain the Northern State and there are people who want a united Ireland. And I think that's different from having a commemorative event and expecting a President of Ireland to attend such an event. But as I said, he has given his view and I respect his view.
Roisin Shortall, I was reading Jennifer O'Connell in her column in the Irish Times today. She's very critical of the President for taking this position. She says he scored a surprising own goal against his self-declared mission to restore and help and heal. And she says if Queen Elizabeth can lay a wreath in the Garden of Remembrance, the President of Ireland can grit his teeth and go to a service commemorating the partition.
I don't agree with Jennifer O'Connell there, I have to say. I think the President, certainly within his rights, but I would agree with the action that he's taken in relation to this invitation. You know, the partition of Ireland
because
is
simply
not...
Simply because of the title of the event, and that seems to be what the President is saying.
Well, yes, it is because of the title.
And again, let me just remind listeners what the title was.
A service to mark...
Of reflection and hope. A service of reflection and hope.
To mark the centenary of the partition and the formation of Northern Ireland. So, like... The partition of Ireland and the formation of Northern Ireland is not something that most people would consider, you know, good developments or something that we should celebrate in any way.
There's nothing in that sentence that suggests anyone is suggesting it was a good development or a bad development either way. It is simply a service of reflection.
It's marking
hope.
It without considering it in the context of everything that has happened since then. And I think the President was completely within his rights to take that view. And it's very important to point out that this wasn't something that happened in the last couple of weeks. You know, the President got this invitation. He had concerns about it 6 months ago and he relayed those concerns.
But isn't that surprising then when we heard and we were told this week that the church leaders who issued that invitation were surprised this week when the news of his refusal emerged? But surely they must have been aware of this because he says he discussed
well,
this.
Well, you would expect
the
they would be. So I don't
March.
Know what lack of communication there was on the northern side of this. But,
yes.
You know, the President was very clear. He notified his concerns 6 months ago and requested that, you know, the title be amended. Now, it's hard to see why that couldn't have happened. And in relation to Gerard's point there about the Department of Foreign Affairs, the President did consult with the Department of Foreign Affairs and, you know, there was unclear advice provided. And the President...
Well, again, I think Gerard is right there. It would be useful if this was written advice and we saw it, because is it unclear? I don't think unclear was the language that was used in relation to it. I think no specific advice
was given. And that's fine. So the President, as is his right, makes up his own mind about these things. And I think most of us would accept that the President has got very good judgment on this and hasn't been slow to get involved in other centenary celebrations.
Surely the reaction to it has to be taken into the thing. And it has upset, and not just extreme, you know, the more extreme elements of unionism in Northern Ireland,
Katie,
but moderate.
I just
moderate.
Say, if the President had accepted that with the title, the existing title, I think we'd be having a very different discussion today. People being concerned about.
Okay,
the
I want to bring Mary.
To
I want to bring Mary.
Invocation.
Mary Butler into this. Mary, we're expecting that the Taoiseach will be invited to this event now. What position will be taken on that?
Well, 2 points. The first point is the President has made his position very, very clear. And this was not a knee-jerk reaction, as Roisin said. He has been considering this for over 6 months. and he raised concerns. And I don't think anyone can doubt the president's bona fides when it comes to reconciliation and commemoration on this island. You know, he's very, very strong there. And his main concern was the title and the structure suggested. And I would fully endorse the president's decision. He is entitled to make a decision for any invitation he gets. In relation to your question, no invitation has been sent to the government in relation to this commemoration.
If one is, does turn up over the next few days?
If one does turn up, it will be given the same consideration as any invitation that comes into the Taoiseach's department.
The speculation this morning is that the Taoiseach could not now accept that invitation because it would be seen as a slight on the president, and so therefore it might be some more junior ranking politician that might be sent.
Well, the Taoiseach was very clear yesterday when he was asked this by the media, and he said he understands where the president is coming from and that he articulated it and he gave his reasons. And, you know, for me, I believe the discussion around this has been a little bit unhelpful, and I think it overshadowed the president's visit to the Vatican this week, whereas unfortunately something that was really positive turned into to more a negative, because the president of our country is entitled to make a decision on any invitation he receives. He set out his stall quite clearly why he felt he couldn't, that a religious event had become a political statement. And I think that's the reasoning behind it.
Gerard, if I can bring you back in on that, what are the moderate unionists that you have been talking to saying to you about this?
There's a deep sense of disappointment. I disagree with what's been said by the panel this morning. There was no clarity in what was said by the president earlier on in this. It turned into a political issue because of the statement made by the president. It is so uncharacteristic of the president that it is difficult to accept. And this is why the more moderate unionists are finding it difficult to accept. There are two words in that statement. In the title of the day, there is reflection and hope. And any of us sitting in this country today, north or south, would want to reflect on the history of this country with the hopes that we might have for the future of a new Ireland, an Ireland that would embrace all traditions. And this is where I feel that we have scored an old goal on this particular one. And I agree with the speaker who said the Taoiseach could not now attend if he was invited. The president cannot change his mind at this stage. It would be seen that he's been forced into it. So I think we've missed an opportunity to extend the hand of friendship to the more moderate unionists, and we have actually enraged the more radical unionists. So I think we have set things back just a little.
Okay, before we leave this, you just wanted to
no,
get in there,
I don't
David.
Believe that at all. I don't accept that last contribution, and obviously people are entitled to their own opinions. I think Michael D. Higgins' track record speaks for itself in terms of reconciliation, putting out the hand of friendship to unionists. He has laid wreaths at events in the north, as has Martin McGuinness in the past, and the current leader of Sinn Féin in the north. So there has been many, many gestures across the political divide, I have to say, in recent years, which has been about hope and has been about reconciliation. But I think this particular event was different. I think the president exercised his best judgment. I don't see it as a step backwards. And in fact, I think more moderate unionists would accept, in my view, the logic of his position. We'll hear the loud voices. But I would say there are many moderate unionists that would understand and the position that was adopted by the president.
This, of course, won't be the only event marking the centenary of the formation of Northern Ireland. Will Sinn Féin attend any of those events?
Not any events that would mark it or commemorate it, but we have no problem having discussions and debates with members of the unionist community or others who have different opinions. And I think that's a different issue when you politically argue your points. You look at the history, the insights, and also the wrongs that happened because of partition.
They were just going to pray.
But I'm a United Irelander. I want to see a United Ireland. There are people who have different opinions, but one of the consequences of partition was conflict and all of the hurt that came from that. And I accept there was hurt that was inflicted on both sides. But it is not something, in my view, to be either celebrated or commemorated in any way, certainly not by the President of Ireland.
Okay. We'll leave that one there. We'll take a break. But after this break, we'll hear an extraordinary story of what happened when one female academic attempted to conduct a study on the Defence Forces.
tweet at SaturdayRTE.
Now, if you were listening to Radio 1 at this time last Saturday, you would have heard the voices of former female members of the Army, Naval Service and Air Corps describing the discrimination, bullying, sexual harassment and sexual assaults they experienced while serving in uniform. The Women of Honour documentary came 21 years after Dr. Tom Clonan's PhD research first exposed this culture in the Defence Forces. In 2006, Dr. Shirley Graham was also given permission to conduct her PhD research on gender issues in the Defence Forces in relation to the deployment of women on Irish peacekeeping missions. Earlier this year, she submitted an account of her experiences while conducting this research to the Commission on the Defence Forces. Speaking to me from Washington, where she's now Associate Professor of International Affairs with George Washington University, Dr. Graham said she quickly realised that female soldiers were reluctant to speak to her because of the backlash there had been to Clonan's research. So she decided she'd have to travel to a peacekeeping mission to recruit participants for her research. Just to say, there is some content of a graphic nature in this interview.
I attended a course prior to deploying to that mission myself. And it was very interesting for me that one of the senior male officers during the coffee break said to me, "Shirley, do you know what the two biggest problems on a peacekeeping mission are?" And I just said, "What are they?" And he said, "Women and alcohol." And it was only me surrounded by a group of men. And they all laughed. So again, just another kind of early signal in terms of the culture of the Irish Defence Forces and what I was going to be dealing with throughout my research process.
And then you did actually personally experience sexual harassment.
On my first evening, after I had spent some time in the officers' mess, I simply went to use the toilet. A man followed me in and he exposed his penis to me. I didn't say anything or do anything at the time. I went back to my room and I double locked the door to be sure of my own security. I didn't report it. I very much regret that. But I think I was really concerned about being seen as making a fuss and then potentially that would have adverse impact on my research. Possibly people wouldn't want to talk to me. I myself could get labelled as a bit of a troublemaker, so I kept quiet about it.
And just to be clear, the person who did that, who exposed himself to you in that toilet...
It was a male member of the Irish Defence Forces. I don't know what his rank was.
Ultimately, you discussed issues around harassment with the female members, but those stories never appeared in your final thesis. Why?
Yeah, this was a really complicated situation for me and one that created a huge amount of distress and anxiety. Firstly, I had to sign a performer with the Irish Defence Forces to basically receive permission to conduct the research in the first place. Now, what that meant was that all of my data and content would be passed through the Human Resources Department, and I would have to seek approval from them to put my data into my final thesis, which would go before my examining board. So all the way through the research process, I was concerned about this, that my data would be withdrawn and I would have no thesis at the end of the process. So I was advised by a colleague to send a draft to a senior male officer in the Irish Defence Forces who was considered to be a rational intellect and who would give me a good steer. This particular officer came back and his response was simply that he was enraged by this chatter. I then had a dilemma. Do I keep it in or do I take it out? He said it was questionable whether I would be able to basically get my PhD thesis approved with that chapter in. It wasn't a given either way, but it was obviously a worry. The second reason was that I was concerned about the welfare of the women who had reported incidents to me. You know, basically, they had not formally reported these incidents. They had chosen not to because they didn't feel safe in the Irish Defence Forces to do so. So what I decided to do instead was I put in a one-page statement saying that these incidents had been shared with me, that obviously there were deep concerns about them and the fact that women didn't feel they could report. And it was the responsibility of the Irish Defence Forces to put in place safe justice mechanisms for women who experience sexual harassment or assault or bullying.
And that chapter that never appeared, what was in that chapter? Can you share with us now?
So, for example, a woman reported being sexually assaulted in a peacekeeping mission by a male peer. There was another incident, a woman experiencing sexual harassment and bullying. And again, didn't report for fear that this would somehow, you know, she'd receive a backlash or it would hinder her promotion opportunities. And also an incident of physical assault. In this case, a woman was actually kicked and beaten by two of her male superiors so badly that she was hospitalized. They even visited her in the hospital to warn her off and to threaten her if she dared to speak out. So these were some of the incidents, and obviously the women were very frightened that, you know, these would become known and that they would experience a backlash, albeit they did want to share these incidents with me and have them included in my research.
There was an incident as well when you were presenting some of your research to a senior officer.
Yeah, I had a couple of different incidents. So I was really concerned that the Irish Defence Forces were not taking my research findings seriously. And so I made several attempts to speak to senior officers. In one of those meetings, I was in a private office with this senior male officer. And as I was outlining my research findings to him and the gender inequalities within the Irish Defence Forces that my research had revealed, this officer actually began to try and play footsie with me under the table as I expressed my research on gender inequities.
That just seems such an extraordinary scenario. Could you have been mistaken?
No, I don't think so, because I pulled my feet away on several occasions, and on several occasions I ended up feeling his foot against mine again, and even against my ankle and my toe. So in the end, I just tucked my feet under my chair to avoid any interaction like that with him again. You have to remember, I was in an office as well by myself with him. And so this was a deeply uncomfortable and embarrassing situation.
Did you say anything at the time or since?
No, I didn't. I didn't say anything at the time. I think it goes back to, again, what I said earlier. You feel like you're somehow making a fuss or being a bit of a troublemaker if you're raising awareness of these issues.
And there was another issue, Shirley, in relation to the research and how it was responded to by the Defence Forces.
Yeah, this was a really devastating moment for me. I had discussed my research in private with a woman officer, and she had said that she agreed with every single word in my thesis. And then later at a public event with other senior male officers present, she essentially said she disagreed with my research and its findings.
You have put all of these issues in a submission to the Commission on the Defence Forces. Why did you decide to do that?
Yeah, it was really important for me to speak out on behalf of the women in the Irish Defence Forces who maybe didn't feel they could speak out on behalf of themselves because of fear that their identities would become known or that there would be some sort of negative reaction or retribution, or it might in any way hinder their promotion prospects. So because of the findings in my own research that set out very clearly sexist attitudes and misogynistic behaviours within the institution, and because of my own personal experiences while conducting this research, I really wanted to put this on public record and make it known. Like I said, because I had felt silenced personally, and because I also knew from my research that women in the Irish Defence Forces felt silenced, I wanted to break that silence and make this story known.
Your research, particularly your field research, dates back a considerable period now into the late noughties. What makes you think things haven't improved since you conducted this research?
Well, first of all, there have been three national action plans on women, peace and security since that time. And those plans have made commitments to increasing the numbers of women in the Irish Defence Forces and also deployment on peacekeeping missions. So, but what we notice since then is actually that despite a recruitment campaign focused on women and seemingly a spend of over €1 million, there has been a very marginal increase in the numbers of women in the Irish Defence Forces. Also, the numbers of women deploying have actually decreased if you look at the annual statistics since that time. So I suppose I have questions around why is that? Why is it that the Irish Defence Forces cannot retain the women they have? And why are they having difficulty recruiting more women? Also, I had a conversation with an Irish woman officer who has since resigned, who told me that she hasn't seen many changes in the Irish Defence Forces since the development of the National Action Plans, and that it looks much better on paper than it actually feels in practice. So it's really, you know, all of these concerns that concern me. And so, therefore, I think we need an investigation and some further research into what is actually happening culturally within the Irish Defence Forces that is creating barriers to women's inclusion.
And that was Dr. Shirley Graham speaking to me from Washington. Roisin Chartle, you were shaking your head as you were listening to that interview. Really some extraordinary statements there by Dr. Graham.
Absolutely. First of all, Katie, well done to you and RTE for that excellent programme last week. But, you know, huge credit to the 8 whistleblowers that participated in that programme, 7 of whom who had reported sexual abuse to senior people within the Defence Forces. And incredibly, nobody was brought to book over this.
And just to say, and it was actually six cases of abuse that had been reported.
Okay, yeah. Six. Like, it is just shocking to think that 20 years after Tom Clonan blew the whistle on this, that there's still a very live culture of misogyny, abuse and discrimination within the Defence Forces. And this issue just has to be tackled in a comprehensive way. I mean, this thing of putting action plans in place is no good. It's about changing the culture. And, you know, that the culture starts at the top, and senior people within the Defence Forces have to take responsibility for a shocking, discriminatory, bullying culture that exists there. And they must take clear steps to change that. Now, part and parcel of that is having an independent investigation following on from your programme. I look forward to that happening at an early stage. I note that the minister just announced a few minutes before this programme started that he's actually going to meet with those 8 whistleblowers from last week. Look, we need action on this. Women have put up with this kind of stuff for far too long. I think, you know, what Shirley Graham has said there today just compounds the whole thing. How somebody coming from outside, even doing an academic study, could still be subject to sexual abuse in this way. It's
absolutely shocking. And I should say as well, even though that field research was from, I think, 2006 to 2009, she didn't complete that thesis until a number of years later. So some of those experiences about what happened when she was presenting her research would be, you know, much more recent than that. So
sure, and that is
and that is after we've had the internal the independent investigation into these issues after the Clonan research and all the monitoring group reports that followed on from that. David Cunanan.
Listen, what we've heard again today and last week from survivors themselves has been nothing short of astounding and shocking. There are obviously deep cultural problems within the Defence Forces, right at the very top, it would seem. And that's not to do a disservice to any individual, but there are cultural problems, organisational problems that obviously have to be tackled. And I think that what we need is a full independent inquiry into all of the allegations, because I think if you have an inquiry within the Defence Forces itself, I'm not sure that will satisfy survivors. And the experience that we've just heard over the last few minutes reiterates that very, very loudly and very, very clearly. And any allegations of harassment or abuse of any nature has to be first of all examined, but also the culture that leads to it has to be rooted out. And if that means people from the outside coming in to lead an investigation on the one hand that establishes all of the facts, but also then puts in place the practical changes which need to come about, has to be done. But men in the Defence Forces should know better. And as I say that as a man, it's absolutely unacceptable to hear what we have heard today again and over the last week.
Okay. Minister Mary Butler, when the response, the initial response to our documentary last week was, look, we have an independent review that we're in at an advanced stage of establishing. And so we'll talk to the women of honour and we will, you know, we'll include their thoughts in terms of reference and that. But is that good enough?
No, it's not. And thankfully that response has been updated today. I listened back to that podcast this week, and as a woman, I was just chilled. Do you know that feeling in the pit of your stomach, thinking of this bullying culture, the sexual harassment, the sexual assault, the abuse, the misogyny, as both speakers have said. And I really want to commend each and every one of the brave women who have spoken out. But Katie, and I want to thank you as well, but what really struck me in the podcast was one of the lines one of the women said, I think it might have been Karina, when you talk out, it can be a career-ending moment. And that's why the women were so afraid to talk out. But look, what I will say is I am delighted that the minister will be meeting with the women of honour very, very soon. And he has stated in his statement that the terms of the establishment of an independent review are being reviewed. And I can confirm that they will be conducted by independent, unbiased personnel. And that's what needs to happen, an independent review. But like what David said, the culture has to change as well, because I cannot believe this is 2021. And to think or imagine what members of the Army, the Naval and the Air Force, female members, have gone through. I'm sick to my stomach, I'll be honest.
The inquiry, this is the Women of Honour asked that the inquiry needs to examine not just policies and procedures, but the actual incidents and the culture. Can we get a commitment that that is what we're now talking about, Minister?
Well, sorry, I'm just reading through the press release that was released at 1:45 today, and I think the minister has said quite clearly he can confirm that this would be conducted by independent, unbiased personnel, and I think it's absolutely a minimum that that's what will happen, that these women will be listened to and that changes will be made going forward, because this is not a culture that anyone can stand over. And to think or imagine that people, you know, they had hair loss, the stress, the trauma, exhaustion, isolated, the mental anguish for them and their families. It's just a shocking indictment of what has gone on.
Okay, we leave that there. And as we say, it's obviously a developing story in terms of the department's and the Defence Force's response to these revelations. And I just want to thank Dr. Shirley Graham for speaking to us on that as well. And we'll move on, though, because another obviously huge issue that has emerged in the last week is Sláinte Care and what's happening at the top of Sláinte Care. Liam Dorn, who's of course a member of Sláinte Care's Implementation Advisory Council, says he was none the wiser as to why Laura McGahey and Tom Keane resigned from their positions after they had that virtual meeting with the Health Minister, Stephen Donnelly, yesterday evening. Minister, this is your department. Can you throw any more light on this for us?
Yeah, I spoke with Minister Donnelly this morning, and he said to me that he felt that Liam Dorn's comments were completely at odds with what he felt was a very productive and a positive meeting. The advisory group that he met with, they normally meet four times a year to provide advice on implementation to Laura McGahey. And, you know, they don't report it directly to the minister, but he felt he wanted to meet with them and engage with them. And, you know, the terms of reference of their meetings are confidential. So he was surprised to hear Liam Doran's comments. But firstly, look, I would like to acknowledge and thank Laura McGahey and Dr. Tom Keane for their commitment to Sláinte Care and express regret at their departures and every good wish for their future. But I think the most important thing that has to be said here, the Department of Health last week published a report on the progress in the first six months of the new Sláinte Care implementation strategy. And of 112 deliverables for the first 6 months, 85 were on track and 24 were being progressed. So 97%.
Minister, can I just put you now? Are we really still at the place where we're suggesting that this Sláinte Care strategy has been advanced with any with any degree of urgency?
Well, we absolutely are, because in many ways, COVID has pushed Sláintecare care along, because everything to do with COVID, such as testing, vaccinating, is universal and free at the point of delivery. COVID has shown us what the health service can do with a singular focus.
Isn't COVID what we're being told is the reason that we haven't moved forward with the regionalisation, which is a key part of this? And we're told that we couldn't. So what could we do? We had COVID to deal with.
I don't believe in the middle of a pandemic is the right time to engage in a complete reorganisation of the country's health services. Minister Donnelly took this decision and believes it was the right decision. Like, it's only a short while ago when we had 8,000 cases of COVID a day, and we had 7,000 frontline workers out sick due to COVID. So I think we have to be realistic here.
Okay, Roisin Shorten.
Katie, we also have to be honest, of course, and Minister Donnelly continues to gloss over the fact that there's a serious issue here. The vested interests are holding up the critical reform that is set out in Sláintecare. There's huge institutional resistance to the introduction of new structures within the HSE, which are designed to ensure accountability for the provision of services and the spending of budgets. Look, the Health Committee invited the Minister in next week to talk to us about the reasons why these two senior resignations took place. He's refused to come in, and he's saying he won't be available to come in until after the budget, a month away. That's just not acceptable. And that's the reason why, Katie, I have written now to the chair of the Health Committee proposing that we invite in Professor Tom Keane and Laura McGahey to give us firsthand their reasons for resigning. They're two very significant people. They're a massive loss, and we need to hear from them exactly why they felt they had no choice but to resign.
Okay, we haven't had a response to that letter yet. The letter's just gone out.
Yes.
Okay.
I think first of all, Minister Donnelly and indeed Minister Butler need to take their heads out of the sand on this one, because if you look at the two very senior resignations, it cannot be seen as a vote of confidence in Sláintecare and the delivery of the big reforms. The review that Mary was talking about, when you actually look at it, elective centres, very, very far away from it, possibly it's 10 years before we see that. We have waiting lists at record levels at 900,000. We still haven't made the reforms in relation to unique patient identifiers, a centralised referral system, for example. We haven't put the capacity into healthcare. Of the 1.2 billion that we were told was new money for new measures last year, about 300 million of that we're being told now will be unspent, which will mean 160 beds which should have been brought on stream, not brought on stream. There was a big figure put in last year's budget, a big bold statement by the Minister for Health, I'll recruit 15,000 staff. About 7,000 or 8,000 of those will not be recruited this year. The statutory home care scheme is not in place. The statutory home care office is not in place. The regional health areas, which were promised, are not being delivered. But if you go to the fundamentals of healthcare, which is taking private medicine out of public hospitals, no moves have been made in that direction.
Yes, but let's talk about what was achieved.
If you look at universal GP care, we legislated for all children up to 12, and even that is far behind the targets. It's now only available to children up to 6 to move up to the 8-year-old. So we're far, far behind on the big issues. And what do we have? 900,000 people on waiting lists, 200,000 people waiting over a year for a diagnosis. And I've known many people who've had to go private to get a diagnostic exam because they can't.
Yes, but
can I just ask you one thing, Mary Butler? Because I understand on good authority that the Secretary General of the Department of Health was informed a number of days before the Minister became aware of Laura McGahey's intention,
by the way, and he never
to resign.
He never expressed that opinion to me. We had a very lengthy discussion about
if I could just come in there. Look, Miss Laura McGahey is completely entitled to talk to the Sec General about any decision she wanted to make in relation to her resignation.
Have relayed that information to the Minister?
Well, my understanding is that Laura McGahey wanted to speak to the Minister in person, and like the Sec General is responsible for over 700 staff in the Department of Health.
I actually can't let you make that point. I'm sorry, Minister. We have to go off there, I'm being told. But before we sign off today, I do want to pay tribute to the former presenter of this programme, the great Rodney Rice, who passed away sadly last month. Rodney presented this programme, which was then called Saturday View, for 25 years, and he is sadly missed by all of his colleagues here in RTE. We remember him with much respect and deep admiration. Our sympathies to Rodney's wife Margot and his children Cian, Katrina and Owen, Ereshte Gorevanan. And that's it. That's all we have time for. We will see you again next Saturday. I'll see you on Tuesday night on Late Debate, but until then, enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Saturday with Katie Hannan. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player app.